Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And that's where we archive the programs. Richarddugan.com, we have a live link to listen. Just click on that, and you can listen to the program either Sunday morning, evening, or Monday early morning if you happen to be up. Or you can also go to that archives page and listen to the interview anytime you'd like. Click on the link to our guests. We encourage you to do so, and we encourage you to check out the information that our guests have on their websites. I think it's extremely important, very valuable. Today's program is a rather interesting one because even though we're going to focus on a particular area of the world, it's a rather large area of the world. I was quite curious as to when using the sort of generic or coverall phrase or word to describe a particular continent, if you will, of the planet, I came to realize that there's a list of what seems like, you know, as long as my arm, countries that are a part of this continent. We're going to be talking with the author of Access to Asia, Your Multicultural Guide to Building Trust, Inspiring Respect, and Creating Long-Lasting Business Relationships. We're going to talk a little broader than that as well. Sharon Schweitzer, JD, is my guest, and I want to thank you so much. You've co-written this with Liz Alexander, and thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure, Richard. I'm happy to be here today.
This is interesting because, obviously, most people probably don't realize how large a region Asia is. I didn't really. I mean, you'd think I would have retained some of that geography when I was going to school, but it's a huge area, which also means that it also encompasses a very diverse set of cultures. And so when you talk about doing business or anything else in Asia, you have to learn an awful lot. Or have you found a way to sort of hone that down into sort of a catch-all, so to speak, to be able to relate with the various peoples of all of these diverse countries?
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point, Richard. And some of your listeners may want to know that, depending on who's counting, there may be between 48 and 52 countries in Asia, because some of these countries have different areas that lay claim to them, and some of them are still in dispute. For example, Tibet, Hong Kong, Taiwan, some of these areas are in flux, and so it depends on how you want to count them, whether you count them as part of China, whether you count them as freestanding or special administrative regions. So many times we see the country count in Asia vary depending on who's doing the counting. So it is a huge region geographically, and that doesn't even include the country count. So what we did when we decided to write this book was we hired a global intelligence firm called Stratfor, and we asked them to narrow this down for us for U.S. American business travel to Asia. And we said, can you help us identify the current and future top-ranking countries for U.S. investment and travel? They came back and they said there are six countries, China, Hong Kong, Japan, India, South Korea, and Taiwan, that are going to account for over 70% of all U.S. business travel to Asia. These countries also represent the top U.S. regional trade partners, as well as key destinations for U.S. investment. So we looked at those six countries and said, okay, out of that big list of Asian countries, we definitely want to include these six in the book. Then the other thing that Stratfor told us was that there were also some other countries that were likely to emerge as increasingly important destinations for U.S. business travelers over the next 20 years. Now, these top-ranking countries are Singapore, the Philippines, and Malaysia. So those were the additional three. Now, there is another country that I have always been fascinated with, and I've tried to visit that country, but it's been closed for over 30 years, which is now open, and that country is Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. So that's how we came up with the list of the 10 Asian countries. Of course, we also discuss global culture and U.S. business culture in this book.
Now, you made reference to how you used the percentage of 70% of business travel. And I'm curious as to why it is necessary to travel when we have the internet and the ability to communicate literally around the world instantaneously.
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. I know we only have an hour, but let me give you the short answer.
Okay.
One of the most important things, there are two things. First of all, one of the big concepts in this book that answers your question is there is this erroneous assumption that there are universal ways of thinking, feeling, and behaving around the world, and there are not. Richard, this bias has played out in organizations day after day worldwide, and we see it all the time as it relates to leadership and management research and advice. For example, there are a number of Western neuroscience institutes that claim certainty is a constant drive for the brain. We all crave certainty. Well, you know what? We don't. In fact, there are some studies, some various dimensions of national cultures that have considerable differences that show very different tolerance for uncertainty or ambiguity, especially in Asia. So there are various ways we measure ambiguity and that we measure how we tolerate uncertainty. The other word for that is risk. Some people tolerate risk well, others don't. And you can see examples of that in people who invest in the stock market. But there are very different examples in Japan. Japan is not a risk-taking culture. They are an island. They are subject to tremendous forces of nature, tsunamis, earthquakes, they get incredible weather. They are not a risk-taking culture, according to the dimensions of national cultures. The U.S., oh, we are risk-takers. We will take risks. We have no problem with risk as a culture, as a national culture. We don't. Now, some individuals within our culture may be less risk-taking, but when it comes to extreme sports, we are right up there.
Mm. Okay.
Now, the other reason that we do not, it's important not to just use Skype or just email, in addition to the fact that there is not just one way of thinking around the world, is because relationships are dynamic. Regardless of our home country, we all share this common desire to relate. You know, the Gallup organization has the Strengths Finder, and we all have these personal themes. Of the top five that were common internationally, achiever, learner, relator, responsibility, and strategic, relator was in the top five, and that's regardless of whether it's in the U.S. or whether it's international. So whether we're from Baltimore or Bangalore, San Francisco or Shanghai, we all want to relate. It's one of the three primary themes for all of us.
Mm.
And you can't relate over Skype as well, or email as well as you can face-to-face and in-person. So spending that time to build trust, inspire respect, and create long-lasting business connectedness is just crucial. It's very important, and it's very much valued in Asia, in the Middle East, in parts of Africa, in other countries and other cultures. They value that. They don't see the time is money concept quite the way we do here in the U.S.
Well, now that's an interesting perspective for them to take, and especially China, considering the fact that they are probably a greater contributor to our lifestyle, you know, with electronics and so forth. And I know, too, that it also used to be Japan that used to supply us with, you know, a myriad of all of the different things they, you know, they may not have discovered them, but they can make them apparently better or faster, maybe not better, but faster than we can. And so that's what they've done. And it just it seems almost sort of an irony, if you will, Where are most of our electronics made? In a country that wants to have face-to-face. And I find that rather interesting. I don't know if you've made the same kind of observation or not.
Well, it's been interesting to watch what's happened. I think we here in the U.S., you know, we can talk about the politics and the labor aspects of us outsourcing a lot or offshoring, but now we're seeing that trend is reversing. Mm-hmm. People are bringing the work back, and it's coming back to the U.S. So things are changing. We see, you know, the outflow and the inflow. So many times the work has been outsourced, and it's been done in China, or it's been done in India or Bangladesh because of the less expensive labor.
Now, what is really interesting about that is the fact that it's as if certainly companies are looking at their bottom line here in the United States, and they're always looking for less expensive ways of doing things, you know. Especially if you want to take a look back at 2007, 8, 9, 10, you know, with all of the hoopla that went up over all of that. And I've been in the process for the last, I'm going to say 18 years of learning the concept that that's just the price, period. In other words, if we actually were paying the actual price that it cost for particular goods and services, it'd be a lot higher, and that's just what it is. Gasoline in particular, which I know we don't import from Asia, that at least as far as I know, we don't. The price at the pump is just the price at the pump. There's nothing you can do about it. You either pay it or you don't. And to complain about it doesn't change anything. And so, again, that's the mindset I've been getting into is if you're going to purchase something or a service from someone, then you pay them what it is that they're asking, unless you're willing to and they're willing to negotiate something along those lines. But usually, again, whatever the sticker says is the sticker. And yet business is always looking for something cheaper instead of making it here in the U.S. And it used to be a big deal to say made in America. But a lot of people, and maybe I'm part of this group, who I don't care where it was made. I want to know that it's going to last. I'm not going to change my cell phone every 6 months and buy the latest and greatest. What about that aspect of the Asian culture in these countries that you've talked about in terms of the manufacturing and providing of a product or service? I should even include services that are quality. In spite of some of the news stories about some of the products that have come out of Asia, China in particular, that are harmful, you know, lead paint and some of the kids' toys and so on and so forth. What's the perspective there?
What is interesting about this is, and we talk about this in Access to Asia, we talk about the fact that one of the most important things to do is to vet and to find out who it is you're doing business with, who are the founders of the company, who are their banking relationships with, what is the background, how is the financing for the company handled. All of these things are crucial. You know, a lot of times, you know, when you're determining where the power and authority rests within a country, an Asian country, it's really important to hire not only a U.S. firm but also a Chinese firm to find out when the company was started, who had the previous ownership, if there was previous ownership, and investigate those investor and banking relationships, because you can find out a lot about quality control. You can find out a lot about the history with other products, service standards. You can also find out whether there's been any kind of previous recall or whether they have a good history and a good track record, because many times that's what they want. One of the things that drives these long-standing relationships, and one of the things that I think many people in the U.S. don't understand, is that in Asia, people live in communities and they do not move. They stay in these communities. So you have great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, children, grandchildren who stay in these communities long-term. So if they are embarrassed by a recall or by a product failure or a service failure, that embarrassment stays with that family for numerous generations. It is extremely difficult for them to move. Like in the U.S., we'll move from New York to Dallas to L.A. and then to Vancouver. We don't think anything about that because our jobs take us like that. So if there's an embarrassment or something happens, people will just get up and move geographically. That does not happen in China or in Japan. So they, number one, they have a high suicide rate. Number two, that kind of embarrassment is what we call losing face. And they do not want that to happen. So that's why it is so difficult to become part of the in circle. You want to be introduced. You want to do business. It takes a long time to create that, build the trust, inspire the respect, and create that long-lasting business relationship because they don't want those failures. They don't want to have the family embarrassed because it lasts 50, 100, 150 years. It lasts generations. So we do read about these things happening, but the fallout is tremendous. The fallout for the families is phenomenal. It's devastating. And they do not want that.
You know, it's a shame that, and you know as well as I do which manufacturers they are, it's a shame that the many car manufacturers that we've seen in the news over the just the last year didn't take the same tack. I can't figure out why it is that it takes a company 7 years to realize that they have a problem with their product, regardless of what it is, and in this case, a car, that takes lives. I still think when I get behind the wheel, man, I'm getting behind this thing that I could wipe out myself and a bunch of other people. And if I didn't kill myself, I don't know that I could live with myself having killed someone else with this machine, let alone that even if it was a manufacturer, a problem in manufacturing that technically wouldn't be my fault, I was still sitting there. So I suppose, in one sense, sort of pleasantly surprised to hear. I mean, I've heard of this whole aspect of, you know, saving face and, you know, honor and so forth within the Asian culture. Is any of this, and I mean, there's a lot. It's like you said, we only have an hour, but is any of what you have learned about relating to the multicultural aspects of Asia, like Western civilization has inculcated almost every other part of the planet, is that starting to happen with the Asian culture? Is it starting to slowly move eastward?
Yes. You know, it's interesting, Richard, and I know your listeners will want to know this. People want to meet in the middle. They really do. When we meet people, and it goes beyond just the handshake where, you know, we go over and we will do a bow and they'll reach their hands out to extend a handshake. It goes beyond that because we're starting to see it with the rules and the relationships because they are relationship-based societies. We are a rules-based society. We have stoplights. We have stop signs. So we have rules in our society that we abide by to keep it orderly. If you go to some Asian cities, you'll notice that there are no traffic lights or stop signs, and traffic just flows or doesn't flow, and there will be all sorts of things happening. One of the best examples I can give you of how the rules and the relationships are starting to meet in the middle is if you've been to China and you're at an intersection, you will see a stoplight up above, but underneath the stoplight, and the stoplight may show green, you know, the sign for go, but underneath that stop sign, you're going to see a police officer fully decked out in uniform who's telling you to stop. So the police officer represents the relationships because it's a person and they have relationships. And they're going to tell the different drivers whether to stop or go, the walkers, the bicyclists. They're in control of the traffic pattern. But if they're telling you to stop and that traffic light, which is the rule, is telling you to go, you have to make a decision. Who are you going to follow? You're going to follow the rule or the relationship? Well, obviously, you're going to follow the police officer because they're going to ticket you if you don't.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But that is an example of meeting in the middle. They're moving away from just police officers or just traffic just flowing, and they're starting to move and integrate in stop signs. They're starting to integrate in traffic signals. So they're starting to integrate in other systems that are rules-based. So it's not just traffic circles and just traffic. It is integrating both systems.
Interesting. And I have to say that I don't have firsthand experience. I have not been to China, but my brother and his wife, who work for Disney, are, and I believe he's still there, working on an amusement park. And he has shared with me, and it's been a while since I've chatted with him, but what little conversation we've had, he has not been too happy with the inability, his inability to be able to communicate and relate with the Chinese workers and engineers and so forth. It is a struggle because they do things differently. It's like he was taught that this is the Disney way of doing things. Well, that's not the way they do it in China. And I think he ran into the same problem in France when they built Euro Disney and so forth. What about individuals and even, I mean, big corporations, they probably have an entire department of international relations. You know what I'm saying? But small businesses or companies, you know, mom and pop, that would love to be able to maybe expand to a bigger market like China. I mean, or Asia in general. And what was it I heard just recently that China in particular, they're now at, what, 1.2 billion or 1.4? They're almost at 1.5 billion people. And then they just changed the they just changed the rules in terms of having more than one child. Now you can have two. But what I find fascinating about that, and this is rather interesting, maybe we can touch upon this just briefly, is that they're changing it for purely economic reasons. But some are saying that it's a little too late because their population is aging like ours. We're still having kids, maybe not as many, and we're not restricted, but their population is already aging and the number of elderly is going to be increasing, and it's going to still take 25 years before, you know, the second child even shows up to become part of the system. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Now that's two parts to that question, and I'll be happy to address both. The first part about your brother who works at Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As someone who travels frequently to China, I have a number of Asian colleagues, and one of my colleagues, we've had a number of discussions about this, and her best advice, and I agree with her on this, just after spending quite a bit of time, years in China, is she says, and I quote her in my book, in Access to Asia, and I think it's on page 87, because I refer people to this quote all the time. She says, U.S. business people get angry thinking the Chinese system is unfair. But what she tells people all the time, here in China, everybody understands the system. My advice to Westerners is to stop thinking the way you do in your own country and adopt the thinking of how to do business in China. Because when a Chinese business person comes up against the problem, they don't look for a lawyer. They look for someone to have a relationship with. The other thing I'll tell you is that as long as I was doing business in China, I always have a local contact who will help me, who will make the calls, make the introductions, explain the situation, tell me who to go to in the government or who to go to in that business office. China is business is politics in China. There's no question. And they will tell you that. They will admit that. You can try to fill out paperwork and go through the process. There will always be another form, and there will always be a different process. You've got to build the relationships in China. You have to change your way of thinking. In the West, we had Aristotle. In the East and in China, they have Confucius. They have Buddha. They have a whole nother way of thinking. And so we can't take our Western thought process and decide it's going to work in another part of the world, because it won't.
As a matter of fact, that Chinese proverb is rules and laws basically here are just suggestions. We write laws with lots of flexibility, as opposed to in this country, we write laws and they're supposedly written in concrete and very difficult to change sometimes. I want to talk more when we get back from our break about this, the whole aspect of relationships. And we're going to do that. We're talking with Sharon Schweitzer, JD. She is the co-author of Access to Asia, Your Multicultural Guide to Building Trust, Inspiring Respect, and Creating Long-Lasting Business Relationships. We're going to talk more about that as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Access to Asia, access to any part of the world that you're not familiar with. I think these rules would apply in a general sense because every culture is a little different. Asia is very unique, Sharon Schweitzer, because the culture is thousands of years old. I often comment to people about medicine, Chinese medicine, for example. And I trust it more than I do any other form because it's been around for 5,000 years. They didn't, or more, they didn't need an FDA. They just knew that they knew that it worked. And so I trust it over that which has been tested and researched and investigated and done double-blind studies. I'll blindfold myself and say, go ahead, bring on the Chinese herbs and poultices and all that kind of stuff, because I'm willing to do that. I want to talk a little bit also about, as I said as we're going into the break, about relationships. Now, you're dealing primarily with business relationships. When I was being trained to be a salesman, which I never finished the training, I am not technically a salesperson, but nonetheless, I was told that doing sales or marketing, what have you, it's all about relationships. I had a problem with that because I felt that establishing a relationship with someone was under less than honorable intentions, because my job was to sell them something. So I'm going to establish a relationship to sell them something. Tell me about the difference in the relationship that you've described when dealing with folks across the Pacific in the Asian countries.
Well, I think you also have to stop and think about the difference in the cultures. So the first, you know, you have to kind of step back to the beginning of our interview when you asked that really wonderful question about, you know, kind of what makes this book different. And that is, there are no universal ways of thinking around the world. So our Western way of thinking about sales is just that. It's a Western approach. In the East, in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East, they all have different ways of viewing sales, of viewing relationships. So that assumption about, or that, our Western way of approaching sales is just that. It's a Western view. So the Eastern view, their view is that relationships are dynamic and that relationships are important. And for them to do business with anyone outside of their culture, they're going to have to really trust that person. And if they think, well, they're just here to do a transaction, why should I do business with them? Because they could potentially take advantage of me, embarrass me, and leave. So I'd rather do business with my own people. I'd rather do business with other Chinese, other Japanese, other Koreans. So in order to do, if you want to do business in Asia, you are going to want to develop a relationship. If you don't want to do business in China or in the Philippines or in Malaysia, then this won't apply. But there is a difference And the big difference is the mindset. A big part of it, I think, really starts with self-awareness, because we have to understand our own U.S. culture. We have to figure out what is our culture. We can't figure out kind of where we stand in relation to another culture until we have a better handle on ourselves. So that self-awareness is crucial. Once we have figured out our own culture, what our dynamic is, we're much more successful. If we are not aware of our own culture, we are conducting business at a distinct disadvantage. So we have to know, how do we view power and authority? How formal or informal are we? How do we, like what you're suggesting, how do we handle sales? What's our comfort level with unequal power distribution? Once we figure out our current mindset, our behavior, do we have a growth mindset or is it more limiting? Then we can figure out, how am I going to do business in China or Korea or in Myanmar? Because it's going to be different in all those places.
What?
So
let me ask you in regards to, because I've given, you know, the end game, if you will, of a business relationship in the United States, at least the stereotypical end game. What's the end game in an Asian business relationship? What are they trying to achieve?
Well, okay. Let me give you an example. I was in Hiroshima, Japan recently. I was meeting with a new client, and his first words as we were sitting there discussing a new solar project, his first words were, "We want to build a personal relationship. We do not want litigation because the Americans always win." So he wanted the right mindset. He wanted to look forward. He said good things will happen. That's what he was interested in. His questions were interesting because he said, "Now there's a team of six, but only two of you traveled over here. What happened to the other four?" So his end game was, this is supposed to be a team. You know, I want things to work out. We had a contract. And he told us immediately, you know, he wanted this to be long-term. I mean, the words came out of his mouth. I thought, I wish I had met him when I was writing the book. This would have been great for my book. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I just, you know, of course, I wrote all that down in my notepad. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is incredible. This is exactly what I'm talking about. But, and it was amazing to me to hear him say the Americans always win. You know, my father was in the Navy, so of course I, you know, told him as soon as I got back to the U.S., but it's always interesting to see these things, because that was exactly what he wanted, a long-term relationship. He didn't want a long, detailed contract. He wanted to make sure we were in this. You know, they're wanting to build a community, a long-term community that is fueled by solar. Well, you don't just, you know, that's not just a, hey, quick transaction, let's pop that puppy up. That is long-term. That is a number of years to build that and to work those relationships.
Well, it just seems to me that, you know, we in the West, and I don't know whether the West encompasses much more than the U.S. per se, because we've sort of spread our Westernization to the east of us. I find that interesting. Maybe it's because the Pacific is so large and it's just so difficult to circumnavigate that, you know, the Atlantic, we call it the pond. And so we go to England, we go to Europe, we go to Africa, and Asia is still pretty far away. Even if you go that direction, it doesn't seem as though, in spite of what we're seeing, like, for example, in China, the, shall we call it the capitalization of China over the last, 30, 40 years or so, that other than that the villages, the small communities that you talk about, they haven't shifted. They're still living the way that they were, hundreds, if not maybe thousands of years ago?
Well, it's interesting because you'll go into some of the smaller villages and they have cell phones. But I did an interview recently with a Thai publisher, a Thai newspaper, and they had some interesting questions for me. they wanted to know if I thought that the Western handshake was going to become obsolete. And I said, what makes you ask that? They said, well, we think that East and West are merging and converging and meeting in the middle. And I said, well, I do agree with that. I think I do see some of that, but I don't think there will be cultural convergence. I don't think that everyone is going to forget their own customs. I said, I think everyone likes their customs. We like our heritage. We respect our heritage. And I don't think people will give that up easily. And they said, well, here's what we think. We think the U.S. and the Western handshake spreads germs. We think it causes a lot of flu. People shake hands. They don't need to do that. We are wondering if you think the Eastern way of doing things with a bow and a nod is more healthy, it's more hygienic, there's no touching, there's no spreading of germs. Do you think that will be accepted by U.S. Americans and by the West? And I said, no, I don't. We respect our customs and our culture, and this is the history of the handshake, to show you had no weapon in your hand. We judge people, their character, their motivation, their confidence based on their handshake. We have names for them like Limp Fish and Bone Crusher, and no, I do not think that we are going to give that up, just like I don't think you are going to give up your customs, you know, like the Cambodian nop and the different bows and nods. And no, I don't. I don't think you will give those up. I don't think we will give ours up. I do think we will meet in the middle and respect each other's cultures, but I don't think those types of things will be put to the wayside. And it was very interesting when the article came out. They showed two hands shaking with red germs all over them.
Well, now, I'm curious as to how these relationships that are being established during, and we'll go ahead and say peacetime, we're relating, we seem to be getting along okay for the most part. You know, I mean, there are obviously some rough edges here and there that we're trying to work out with certain individual countries. But in general, but what do you think this is going to do down the road? What do you think this is going to foster for the future of not just businesses across the ocean, but even governments? Does this whole concept transcend to the government level?
Yes. Recently, I was in Myanmar, and I was attending Association of Southeastern Asian Nations conference, and the Burmese ministers were there, the president was there, the French embassy, the ambassador was there. It was fabulous. There were just people from all different levels of government, industry, and the whole purpose was to bring everyone together and talk about the status of women and economics in Myanmar. And to watch the discussion and to watch how people interacted, one of the things that was very clear was that the people in Myanmar, they've been a closed country for 30-plus years. They want to maintain their culture, but they also want to improve their infrastructure. They want to have access to transportation. They want improved roads, but they don't want the greenfield advantage there to just be taken advantage of, and just they don't want to be just rolled over, bulldozed over. So they are being very cautious about how they're allowing that to happen. So you see where they appreciate their own culture. They don't want it to become too westernized, but they also really appreciate certain aspects. And the generational differences are, we could talk about that at length also. The younger generations like some of the equality concepts. They don't like some of the inequalities. But the people who are making the decisions, who are owning the companies, and who run the chaebols, they are the ones who are entrenched and appreciate and respect the culture and the heritage, and they're the ones making the decisions about who is going to run the future, who is going to be in power in the future. And they're making those selections and decisions very carefully.
Very interesting. I'm wondering, are they, are in spite of everything that you've shared with us thus far from your book here that you've co-authored, Access to Asia, and it seems as though these practices weren't just developed a couple of decades ago. These go back, again, as far as the civilizations do, in terms of this concept, especially of relationships on all levels. And you sort of touched on something that spurred a thought in me in terms of the exposure to the West in Asia through the technology. You referenced, of course, the younger people, and I made reference, of course, to the older folks who are going to be a much larger population in the coming years, decade or two. I'm curious as to the influence that's having on the mindset, on the attitudes and so forth of the young people, to continue to foster and carry forward, or is there no concern there that, hey, we have our way of doing things and this is the way we will always do it?
Oh, no. I think it's having a tremendous impact. You see it all the time. One of the best examples I can think of is all the young ladies in India who ride around on their motorcycles and their motor scooters. I mean, you would not have seen that 20 years ago. That would not be possible.
Now, you say that would have been possible because the laws basically did not allow women to drive?
No, because the women would not have been on little scooters in India.
It's not what they would have done.
No, okay. They would not have done it.
Okay. So there's
now they can do that.
Now they can. And
yes, they can.
Now, from your perspective, and again, I don't know how many trips and how much time you've spent in these various countries, but I'm curious as to the influence that these cultures have had on you. How have these experiences changed you?
Well, it's, you know, there's a study that says the mindset, your mindset impacts your life. And I think the travel I've had, I've been to all 7 continents in 60 countries. 63, I think, at this point. But the majority of them have been a mix and not just Asian. And I think what has happened to me is that I have an open mind in terms of wanting to see and learn. I think mindset and success are intertwined. I adjust to new and unique cultures, but I don't lose myself in that process because I establish personal boundaries, and I know just how far I'm prepared to modify and how far I'll go as situations arise. Richard, some activities are not for me,
mm-hmm.
But I know this. I know this beforehand, and it saves me a lot of grief, and it saves face for me and for my business partners, whether it's in Africa, the Middle East, Europe, the UK, so I can refrain from participating without judging other cultures. So I think my approach is to keep an open mind to new experiences and try not to hold rigid beliefs. You know, I don't want to have a fixed mindset. I want to have a growth mindset and consider challenging experiences to be essential as part of me developing newer abilities.
Interesting. So,
well, you know,
go
as
ahead.
I was going to say, well, one of the most interesting things to me is, you know, I thought we in the U.S. developed the selfie. I found out the Philippines is the selfie capital of the planet, and it is the text capital of the world. Now, as much as I see our young people using iPhones and, you know, mobile devices, I would have thought for sure we were, but I was wrong.
Hmm. Interesting. I was unaware of that myself. But by the same token, I've heard so many different stories about various inventions over the centuries that Americans have been given credit for because somehow they got to, so to speak, the patent office first, but they didn't really discover it. And I often wonder, it actually reminds me of the character Chekhov in Star Trek, the original series, where every time somebody would ask about an invention, he'd say, oh, yes, we discovered that, or we invented that. The Russians did. And the Americans seemed to be sort of doing the same thing. Marconi was the guy that got there first. Ford was the guy that got there first. But it was actually a German who developed the car first.
Oh, you're right. You're right. That's exactly what's happened. I mean, a lot of people don't know the emoji, the little emojis.
Yeah.
Those were invented in Japan.
And just by virtue of the name, that's what kind of occurred to me when I first heard the word. Emoji? That sounds Japanese, along with anime, you know, that type of thing.
You're right. And you know, it's, yeah, credit for how things come about is certainly interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm not sure just exactly how important all of that is, but nonetheless, it just seems like we keep rewriting history in that fashion. And instead of being grateful for the fact that the Japanese developed the emoji, the Philippines developed the selfie. Thank you. Not that I've ever. Well, no, I take that back. I for some reason, every time I think of selfie, I think of the selfie stick, and your phone is out there hanging out there off of this stick and you're taking a picture of yourself. But I have taken a few. I've taken a few selfies, but they've only been of me. I've never said, hey, come here, gang, here. Let me put my phone up here and we'll take a picture of all of us. I have never done that for what that's worth. For what that's
worth. You know, I have not either. I don't even have a selfie stick, but maybe we should get one. If I get one, can I mail one to you?
Sure. That would be very nice. I will still give credit to the Philippines. You know, let them do that. It just seems as though I'm wondering about this whole aspect of the business world. I mean, we're so interconnected, whether it be business or pleasure, whether it just be establishing relationships. And supposedly Facebook and Twitter have helped to foster that. But I'm not a Facebooker, believe it or not. I do not have an account. And I think one of the reasons is because a friend of mine said that he was out with his wife having dinner one evening. And this guy walks up to them and says, hi, you and I were Facebook friends. And it kind of freaked him out. And that's one of the things I think that does concern folks is that are these really friends? Are these, you know, do we really know these people? Well, it sounds to me like in the Asian cultures, they want to get to know you. And it sounds to me like they really, I mean, genuinely, they want to get to know you. Hey, if you do business, wonderful, but it's okay if we don't. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, because if they don't like what they find, they will not do business with you. I've seen that happen. I've seen it happen where someone claimed to own a property, said they owned a property, we started moving forward, and the Korean side said, we'd like to see the deed to the property. And they were driving around, and they had their Google Earth with them on the and they were sending it to their attorneys. And the attorneys on their side, by the time we finished and met for dinner, they had pulled up everything on the property owner, and it was not the people who claimed they owned the property.
Oh, my.
Because they want to know. They want to make sure you're telling the truth. They want to make sure that the long-term relationship is going to be straightforward. So you have to make sure that, you know, they're going to do their due diligence just like we do.
Yeah.
So that relationship did not move forward, Richard.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. when we talk here on this program about new paradigms for a new world, here you and I, we're talking about, in a manner of speaking, and because I, for lack of a better phrase, in a manner of speaking, we're here talking about old paradigms, but from the standpoint that they work. But here in the West, a lot of the ways in which we are living, they don't work. The comparison between East and West. And I've heard it said that there's a lot that both sides have to offer, but that the Western way of doing things, the East, in a manner of speaking, it's not that they don't want to, it's that they don't need to, because the way they're doing things works just fine for them. Is that also a fair assessment?
I think they're open to different ways of doing things. I think they're open.
Mm-hmm.
I was trained as a lawyer, Richard, so it's really hard for me to agree to leading really well-crafted statements like yours. It's really hard for me.
Well,
your statement is really well-crafted.
I can guarantee you I don't think that you'll be perjuring yourself. but I do appreciate your candor in that respect, and I understand, because we all, for example, you've written this book and you've said a lot of things in this book that you're comfortable with, or you wouldn't have said them, right?
Well, you know, let me just tell you, we researched the Living Daylights out of it, and yes, and we interviewed over 130 people. 100 people were listed as contributors, and we have about 25 anonymous sources, as you can imagine. In some of these, some of these countries are communist countries, and we have one country that they still have active secret police. So we have some people who provided us information anonymously. So, yeah, this has been thoroughly researched and very well footnoted. So, yeah, I'm very comfortable with what's in here.
And yet there are people who write their memoirs, and usually I would think that a memoir would be written, you'd sort of write it before you pass on, so that it is then presented posthumously so people can't attack you. You know, or someone's writing their life story and yet they're still alive. It's like, so how are you going to, you know, postscript on this thing, you know, an epilogue or, you know, that kind of thing. How are you going to do that? And yet, and they'll come out and they'll say all kinds of things about their family and their friends. And they sometimes don't care whether they alienate themselves and destroy relationships. You know, you don't hear that kind of thing going on, per se, in the East.
No, you don't. You don't.
And is it because they respect the relationship?
Yes. And that would be anathema, because you would never do that and allow your family or friends to lose face. You just don't do that. It's beyond inappropriate. It would be anathema. It's just not done. It's not done. The family and friends and those relationships are cherished. Mm. They are valued. That's just not done.
What about the religious, if you will, or maybe that's the wrong word, maybe spiritual is more accurate, influences? I mean, you mentioned Confucius, and many people would put Confucius in one of those categories because of the wisdom, if you will, that Confucius brings. What about that influence in day-to-day living and in especially in business? Is that where this concern for face, concern for honor, concern for relationships and family comes from?
To a certain extent, yes, because in Confucianism, there are systems and relationships. You know, it's considered, we call them belief systems, philosophies, and mm-hmm. religions. And we go through and we describe these on pages 64 and 65 in the book Access to Asia. We talk about how these impact business, because, you know, certain systems are based in certain belief systems. You know, Buddhism is originated in northern India. It's based on the teachings of Buddha or the Enlightened One, and there are four noble truths. So this does impact business. For example, it impacts business in Myanmar. Myanmar is a Buddhist country. It has a higher level of individualism than the other countries in Asia. Okay, most Asian countries tend to be a little bit more collectivist than Myanmar. Myanmar has a very high percentage of Buddhism, and Myanmar was also closed for a number of years, which required people to rely on themselves as opposed to relying on the government. You know, Confucianism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Sikhism, Shinto, Jainism, Judaism, all these, we do an overview of these belief systems, philosophies, and religions. By all means, it is not a dissertation, but it is a very brief overview of these systems and some of the countries where you find them. And it does impact business. Mm. It does impact business. And we go into that that detail. And in fact, we quote some people in the South Korea chapter. We quote a cultural expert who talks about how certain people in South Korea have been resisting the impact and resisting Confucianism concepts for some time. So you see a variety of opinions and a variety of different approaches.
Hmm. And even in that same chapter, earlier in that chapter, you talk about the various aspects, concepts, and terms. And a couple of them I want to touch upon before we wrap up. Communication, eye contact. This one I found rather interesting. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that we might touch on. Formal and informal, gender, gestures, gifts, and so on and so forth. And it just seems to me, and of course it goes on in alphabetical order as well, but it just seems to me that when someone travels to a foreign country, and I've only been to two, and one of them was by ocean on a cruise, so we stopped off at different ports. The other one we spent 4 weeks in Ireland. But that's more westernized. But yet there were still customs and there were still things that you did or didn't do. You know, you were very careful in that regard. But sometimes you don't know. I mean, we hear some of these stories about people who wind up in jail because they didn't know that that hand gesture or that verbiage was, in some cases, illegal, if not offensive and or inappropriate and so forth. What would you recommend for someone? Certainly, obviously, getting access to Asia would be a good recommendation. But in terms of sort of cliff notes, if I'm going to China, what do I need to know so I don't offend people, so that I don't unrelate myself to the people I'm coming in contact with?
Okay. If I was going to give a short list of things to do before I traveled, here's what I would do. First, I would make sure, darned sure, I understood my own culture. And by that I mean know the answer to some questions that you get when you entertain international visitors. When I pick people up at the airport, these are questions I get all the time, and I'm always quiet and I listen to how people in the car answer. And half the time they don't answer the questions right. Number one, is English the official language in the U.S.? People think it is. It is not. There are 28 states that have voted to have English as their official language, but in the U.S., it is not the official national language.
And there's no federal law.
That's right.
Yeah.
There is not. There is not a rule or a regulation or a law declaring it as the official language. Number two, how many time zones are there in the U.S.? You know, in China, there's one. And China is huge.
Yeah.
Here in the U.S., we have a number of time zones. People all the time will say, you know, I was trying to Skype with you, and you had these different time zones. How many are there in the U.S.? And we'll have people just numbers all over the place. They need to know that. So number one, understand your own U.S. culture before you ever try to understand anybody else's. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So understand that. Number two, respect. You've got, if you don't have respect for your own culture, please have respect for someone else's culture. Treat them as they want to be treated. We hear people here all the time disrespecting our president, our senators, and everyone else. Please show respect for someone's culture, because if you don't, you're going to have a really, really hard time in their country. Mm-hmm. They're not going to go out of their way to help you with anything. Number three, learn a few phrases in their language. This applies everywhere. I can tell you that the most formal countries are Japan and France, and I don't have trouble in either of them because I know a few greetings and how to say please and thank you, and they will bend over backward for you.
Mm.
So that will help tremendously. Number four, avoid all hand gestures if you can. If you need to point, use time, like military time, or mm-hmm. use the hands of a clock. You know, it's behind you at 12 o'clock noon, or it's behind me at 6 p.m., something like that. Number five, avoid slang comments. You know, if you're in China, don't say, hello, comrade. That term is reserved for members of the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is kind of understand the laws and know what's inappropriate in Asia. In Singapore, you cannot bring chewing gum even in your suitcase. You can't have it on you. It is illegal.
Well, so I'm kind of with them on that one because of how people dispose of it here.
I know. You walk down the street, and it's a hot day, and it is all over your shoes, everything.
It's bad. Well, Sharon, I want to thank you for those helpful tips, Sharon Schweitzer. And before we wrap up the program, first of all, I want to thank you for taking so much time to share with us your observations and your perspectives through the work that you've put together, Access to Asia, and appreciate it. And I hope that maybe if you find your way here to Santa Barbara, and you'll need to learn the customs of this area too, because sometimes we think that we're a country unto ourselves when we're not. But anyway, again, I thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. I love California. I'd be delighted to be in Santa Barbara. I was born in California, and my research assistant went to UC Santa Barbara.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we know where that is. And before we wrap up the program, let me ask you three final questions that I put to all of my guests. First of all, who is Sharon Schweitzer?
Sharon Schweitzer is a third culture kid. And she is one of six children born in California, lived around the world, traveled to 60-plus countries on seven continents, and married to John with a golden retriever who lives in Austin, Texas.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Help this world get along better by understanding different cultures and having more of an awareness of their own culture.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Help create understanding among worlds.
Again, I thank you so much for joining us. And by the way, we want to give out a website where people can go to find out more, not only about the book, Access to Asia, but also about you and the work that you're doing. Now, I have a website up, but I'm not even going to mention it if it's wrong. So I'm going to ask you to mention the website people can go to.
Yes, it's SharonSchweitzer.com, spelled like Albert Schweitzer, SharonSchweitzer.com.
We encourage people to go to that website and check out the things that you have to offer. Sharon, again, thank you, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.